From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi called on NATO to push Turkey to pull its forces out of northern Iraq. In a telephone conversation with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, Abadi described the incursion by Turkey as a grave violation of Iraq's sovereignty. The Prime Minister also issued a renewed demand for Turkey to withdraw its forces from Iraq in a televised speech Monday.
Iraq. As the Prime Ministry decided, there are plans to maintain good relations with neighboring countries, including Turkey. It asks Turkey to withdraw all their forces out of Iraqi land and respect Iraq's sovereignty. This is a fair Iraqi demand, and we are keen to have brotherly and neighborly relations between us and Turkey. We demand Turkey to respect these relations and withdraw its forces out of Iraqi lands.
Iraq's prime minister noted that Turkish forces are in his country without Baghdad's knowledge or permission. A crowd of Iraqis have gathered outside the Turkish embassy in Baghdad to protest against the military incursion by Turkey. On Sunday, Baghdad gave Ankara 48 hours to withdraw all its troops from Iraq, but Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, said the troops will not be withdrawn. The UN Security Council held a discussion at Russia's request about Turkey's military operations in Iraq and Syria. This was Russia's ambassador to the UN, Vitaly Churkin.
I think it's inconsistent and sort of lack of principle, which we see quite often in the sort of actions, behavior of some of our Western colleagues. But now the situation is within the focus of the attention of the Security Council, so we hope it will help resolve the situation to the satisfaction of the Iraqi government, whose sovereignty, territorial integrity, and independence we all respect.
Press TV's Samson Saiz has more.
Tensions between Iraq and Turkey have risen over Ankara's recent deployment of its troops close to the ISIL-held Iraqi city of Mosul. Turkey has also dismissed a 48-hour deadline by Baghdad to pull out the forces. Turkey deployed hundreds of forces to a camp in northern Iraq last week under the pretext of training anti-terror forces. Baghdad reacted angrily, calling the move a violation of international law, under which any such deployment without the consent of a central government is considered illegal. On Sunday, Iraq gave Ankara an ultimatum to withdraw or face what it called all available options, including recourse to the United Nations Security Council. The Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi also issued an order for Air Force to be on alert for any eventuality. The Arab League and Turkey's main opposition, Republican People's Party, have also condemned the deployment as a blatant intervention in a neighboring country. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the Kurdistan Regional Government has rejected a Turkish claim that the deployment was meant to support a camp that Ankara had set up in coordination with the former Mosul governor. He said the camp is being used by forces loyal to the remnants of the former Iraqi regime and militias linked to former fugitive officials. One of those officials who's fled to Turkey is former Iraqi Vice President Tariq al-Hashimi. He is accused of murder and terrorist activities inside Iraq. The Turkish intrusion into Iraq came shortly after Ankara's motives in the war against Daesh terrorists were questioned. Russia has been particularly vocal in pointing fingers at the ISIL-Turkey nexus. That came after Turkey shot down a Russian warplane near the Syrian border. Russia has revealed that Ankara's support for terrorists is because of illegal oil trade with ISIL-held territories, with benefits directly going to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his family. Despite evidence, the US stepped in for Turkey, saying there's no solid proof linking the Turkish government to the illicit oil trade. However, the latest move may have helped expose Turkey's hidden agenda against its neighbors. Ultimately, this is yet another escalation from Erdogan, and the timing, location, and the vague explanation raise all sorts of questions about what exactly these troops are doing across the border.
Anti-Muslim rhetoric by some U.S. presidential candidates, in particular Donald Trump, is being criticized not just in the U.S., but around the world. In response to Trump's proposed Muslim travel ban, Officials at the UN Refugee Agency warned that heated rhetoric like this could threaten the resettlement of Syrian refugees and other victims of war, CCTV's Liling Tan reports.
The United Nations warns that inflammatory comments such as U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump's call to block Muslims from entering the United States could derail a key resettlement program. The U.S. is the largest resettlement country in the world. The UN Refugee Agency says stopping immigrants and refugees now would be the wrong time because this is when help is needed most.
And we are concerned that the rhetoric that is being used in the election campaign is putting an incredibly important resettlement program at risk that is meant for the most vulnerable people, the victims of the wars that the world is unable to stop.
The UN Refugee Agency says that its resettlement program with the U.S. is already rigorous, including a robust security screening process and involving agencies within the U.S. Departments of State, Health and Human Services, and Homeland Security.
This is the most scrutinized population coming into the United States. It takes 2 years to go through all of the screening steps with the different agencies in the U.S. system before being admitted to the United States.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, said those who refuse to accept Syrians because they are Muslims are fueling ISIL and other extremist groups, giving them a strong argument to exploit Western fears while also bolstering terrorist groups' ability to recruit new members. Liling Tan, CCTV, New York.
Here in the U.S., the reactions to this political hate speech have been mixed, as Press TV's Taibe Koverdi reports.
Anti-Muslim and racist remarks by the U.S. Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump have once again stirred controversy. During a campaign rally in South Carolina, Trump called for a complete ban on Muslims entering the United States.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Trump said the move is a temporary measure in time of war. He previously called for establishing a database for all Muslims living in the U.S. Trump's statement drew quick condemnations inside and outside of the U.S. The UN Refugee Agency expressed concern about the level of anti-refugee rhetoric in the U.S. election campaign. The White House called his remarks contrary to U.S. values and national security interests. Amnesty International slammed the proposal as serving the worst instincts of ethnic and religious prejudice. Executive Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Nahid Awad, says Trump's comments made him sound like the leader of a lynch mob.
This is outrageous. Coming from someone who wants to assume the highest office in the land, it is reckless and simply un-American. Donald Trump sounds more like a leader of a lynch mob than a great nation like ours.
Awad stressed that the racist rhetoric is putting the lives of millions of Muslims and their children in danger. Hate crimes against Muslims in the U.S. have surged recently, especially following last month's terrorist attacks in the French capital. On Sunday, a severed pig's head was thrown at a mosque in Philadelphia. According to Muslim Advocates, a legal advocacy group based in California, there have been 32 anti-Muslim threats, shootings and vandalism cases in the country since the November 13 Paris attacks claimed by ISIL. Muslims in the U.S. condemned terrorist attacks in France, saying ISIL's actions have nothing to do with Islam and its teachings. Many critics say the wrong policies of the U.S. and its regional and Western allies are to blame for the rise of the terror group. The main victims of Daesh are people across the Middle East who are subjected to acts of terror on a daily basis.
With the heating up of the situation in Syria and the Ukraine crisis still simmering and possibly looking at new rounds of escalation, the need for effective conflict avoidance is more obvious than ever. RT's Oksana Boyko spoke with Lamberto Zanier, the Secretary General of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, about some of these hot-button issues.
I think it would be fair to say that the incident involving the Russian plane came as a shock not only to many in Russia, but also to many in Europe, which at the very least shows that our perception of threats, of potential flashpoints, is not exactly accurate. I wonder, how would you assess the security situation in Europe compared to, let's say, a couple of years ago? Which way is it moving?
The way I would put it, and this is one of the challenges we are facing today in dealing with security issues, in that is that on the one hand, we see a return and a strong return of, how can I call it, geopolitics. So we are back to a pre-Cold War phase in a way, and with spheres of influence, alliances, presences, etc. But at the same time, we increasingly realize that we face global threats that are common. So the problem that we have is to make sure that these do not become an obstacle in our cooperation in facing these global challenges.
Absolutely,
and including terrorism, first
but
of all.
As you just expressed, sometimes, you know, those geopolitical agendas are the very creators of those challenges that we are supposedly fighting together. I want to bring you back to the Russian-Turkish tensions for one reason, because I think the most worrying thing about it is that it came as a result of deliberate actions by both sides. And even if the the immediate crisis is contained, the underlying conflict potential is still there. How would you deal with that?
Well, you know, from an OSCE perspective, it's for me a little bit difficult to take a specific position on this incident, because from an OSCE perspective, this is related to a different region.
I'm not asking you to take sides.
But I'm just saying that we are not actively dealing with this. So I'm looking at the process and the repercussions of this, because obviously these incidents and the repercussions of these incidents are in the background of everything we do and the discussions that we have. And it's obviously complicating or potentially complicating things. Even though here we have the Turkish foreign minister, we have the Russian foreign minister, and we have many others. So there is also a good opportunity to try to work out some of the issues. It's one of the steps. But then only focusing on Turkey, it gives you only one part of the picture. If you look at what is happening to Ukraine, in some ways we see the same dynamics. So it is an expansion, if you want, and a further expansion of, how can I say, the frictions that we see in my case, in the membership of our organization, and this bigger divide at a time when I need everybody to be on the same page, mm-hmm. because I need effective policies. Mm-hmm. So this will create, obviously, additional problems for us, mm-hmm. and we'll have to find a way to address them.
Well, let's talk about, again, how we can find a way to address that, because a few weeks ago I saw you participating in the Berlin Security Conference's mm-hmm. debate on security, and you said one interesting thing, that we don't really need to change anything about the European security structure, but we need to change the relationship among the main actors. And again, I think that's the biggest challenge, because when you have a rocky relationship, we know that from our personal lives, it's much more, you know, it's much easier to call it quits or to be adversarial for the rest of your life than to make it work. So again, how would you go about changing the relationship? What needs to be done in order to achieve that?
We have to start from the identification of common interests and try. An example is what we're doing in Ukraine. There are very different narratives on the organization. There is a huge debate about the continuing validity of the principles of the organization, which have been violated. There is a debate on whether there were past violations, how do they relate to each other. So some of the fundamentals are under discussion, and it is important that we should have this discussion, and we need to have a discussion about the rules that govern our relations. But simply having exchange of accusations is not good enough. What we need to do is to have a deeper and a better developed debate on why we are seeing some of the things we are seeing happening. And at the same time, we need also to open up more spaces where, in spite of those differences, we can work together. An example is what we are doing in Ukraine on the ground, when we have an operation which is agreed by Ukraine and with an MOU ratified by the Rada, and where every participating state of the OSCE is attending. So even though the perspectives are different, everybody engages with the same objective.
Well, Mr. Zanier, if you don't mind, I would like to leave the Ukrainian issue for the second part, because I think there are many questions with the regard of the efficiency and the efficacy of the OSCE mission there. But if we could stay on those you know, common challenges as well as common objectives. I think we are living in the era of many firsts because, you know, the incident between Russia and Turkey was, again, the first incident of a direct military engagement between OSCE members. The situation in Crimea, many describe it as the first case of a large territory changing hands. So there seems to be those firsts, sometimes unpredictable, sometimes unpleasant. They seem to become very, very regular. Do you expect more of them to come in the near future?
Well, there is a risk. When I was in Moscow a few weeks ago, I was suggesting to Minister Lavrov that we should consider, and looking again at the potential of the OSCE in some areas, measures to build confidence in relation to possible air incidents and close encounters. We have seen episodes where transponders were down. Now we see the problem in Turkey. So perhaps there is a space also in working towards preventing that kind of incidents. And that in itself will become a measure of trying to rebuild a way of working together, and through that, rebuilding trust. Because the problem we have also is an increasingly lack of trust and of confidence in a way, which is also the basis, if you want, for our work. So if there is mistrust, if the intentions of the other side are always considered potentially hostile, then we risk more of these incidents. So we need also to revert, and I have to look at what is the added value of its tool. The OSCE is a conflict prevention organization. It's a security organization with a soft security approach. So I cannot enter into a field that is not really the one.
Absolutely,
for my
but I wonder if Russia is the right party to discuss that, or the only party to talk about that, because obviously Turkey is a NATO member, and what is really, and I agree with you, it's very, you know, we are all very accustomed to some tensions between Russia and NATO, rhetorical tensions. But what happened this time around is, you know, the first case of using military power unilaterally while also counting on NATO's collective defense clause. This is really a gray area. And I wonder if this Article 5, if used, let's say, deftly and manipulatively, perhaps, could be the source of potential and very strong insecurity, collective insecurity in Europe.
Well, I agree. Incidents of this kind may create repercussions and may have implications that may go well beyond the scope of the incident itself. So on the one hand, we express, I certainly personally express concern for this kind of incidents, but I also express concern for the consequence that this may have. And, you know, I'm not in a position to discuss on the NATO decisions and the Article 5, etc. But to respond to your question, I'm not pushing Russia on this. I'm talking to everybody. Mm. And I'm also pushing the NATO countries to consider developing policies that would be, how can I say, preventing or helping us prevent this kind of incidents. We need to change the atmospherics. The problem that we face is that geopolitics are difficult to address in a multilateral
but
forum.
I find it interesting that you say that we need to change the atmospherics, we need to change the relationship, but we don't actually need to change the setup when we have Russia pitted against an ever-increasing military alliance. And that's right. The crux of the problem, that from NATO side, they're ready to discuss the issues of trust, they're ready to discuss coordination, but they're not ready to discuss, you know, major issues to make security in Europe really collective as opposed to block-based.
Yeah. Well, I cannot, what I can do, I can provide a table for everybody to come there, and I can try to push people to come there to discuss exactly these issues. Are the security structures that we have set up what we should have today? Are they a recipe for long-term stability, which is what we want to see in Europe? We were at the time of the last summit of the OSCE in Astana, we were working towards building a common space of security and stability for the OSCE region. And I think that that is a good objective. But what we've seen developing is, in fact, two spaces. And one is a Eurasian space, and the other one is a transatlantic. And the risk that we see is that the divisions between these two spaces become larger in a way and deeper. And that this is creating problems, and including problems to those countries that find themselves in the space, if you want, between these two. So that's what we're working on. That's what we want to try to avoid.
Now, what I think the Russian-Turkish spat also exposed is that when there is a choice between security and cooperation, the former always prevails, no matter how strong our economic ties, how many stakeholders there are. You know, they do not protect against confrontation. We've seen that in the case between Russia and Turkey. We've seen that in the case between Syria and Turkey and between Russia and the EU. Why do you think cooperation falls so easily by the wayside?
Well, this is why we call our approach an approach of cooperative security, which is for us, we try to push for cooperation on security issues. So we don't want to create an alternative between giving priority to security considerations vis-a-vis perspective of cooperation, but linking the two. Mm-hmm. So we are trying to bring people around the table and have them accept that there are things that they can do together, and they can enhance the security for everybody. The problem is that sometimes security, and too often, and this is again linked to geopolitics, security is seen as a zero-sum game, whereas it can be a win-win for all if we join forces. But there has to be also an effort to do that.
And very quickly, before we go to the break, I want to squeeze a question about one area where security and cooperation collide, and this is, I think, the refugee crisis. Yeah. The current approach in Europe is that Europe really should try and keep those refugees closer to their countries of origin, which essentially means keeping them in Turkey. And I wonder if that's really a realistic proposition in a time when, you know, not only Europe, but the world as a whole has fewer borders. The borders are much more porous. Can you really make those large numbers of people who are on the move, migrating masses of people, stay put in one country?
I see only this as a short-term policy. I agree with you. We need to take stock. We want to have a larger discussion also in the OSCE on this, because we need to understand better ourselves what is happening, what also the future holds for us. We need to understand what are the root causes of these phenomena. It's refugees, but it's also migration. There's economic migration, there's illegal migration, and we need to differentiate it. And keeping migrants in one country is obviously a gap stop measure, but it's not a long-term viable solution.
Well, Mr. Zanier, the OSCE has been heavily involved in monitoring the Ukrainian crisis, which officially has been contained by the ceasefire, but in practice the conflict is still simmering, if not intensifying. What do you see the main hurdle in solving Ukraine once and for all?
In solving Ukraine once and for all, that's a big question. I think we need to take it in steps. The most urgent thing now is really to stop and solve the conflict in the east and the southeast. And there are two tracks. There is the political track on Minsk implementation there, and then there is the engagement on the ground. And the engagement on the ground is, initially, our task was to monitor and report. Now, I think it has taken the flavor of a quasi peacekeeping operation, because there are many things that we do on the basis of a broad mandate, and I think with the support of everybody.
But Mr. Zanier, I think all that work that you just mentioned makes sense only when you have the belief that all the parties involved are really committed to the peace process. Do you have that assurance? Do you have that firm belief that everybody who you're talking to, who you're working with, is really committed to finding a peace solution?
Well, there is Minsk, and there are, you know, the agreements have been signed. So our job is to facilitate, and our job is also to push people to facilitate. So in fact, we are interpreting our role in a proactive manner, in the sense of also trying to put pressure on the parties, to put proposals on the table, and also report back and be vocal when we see cases of non-compliance from every side.
You just mentioned the Minsk agreement, and pledging allegiance to that has become, I think, somewhat similar to expressing support for the two-state solution in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Everybody does it rhetorically, but practically almost nobody follows what they say. Isn't that yet another case when a temporary setup is sort of becoming a permanent status quo?
Well, we don't want this to become a status quo because we don't like the situation as it is. And as you yourself pointed out, the conflict is simmering. The conflict has not gone away. There is a ceasefire that is largely holding, but there are violations of this ceasefire on a daily basis. There are victims on a daily basis or almost daily basis. And obviously, we don't want to see a continuation of that. We are not seeing, Minsk as a mantra in a way, but we see it as the best solution that we have in our hands. So we really feel that we have to invest as much as possible to make it work. And that is, in a way, the direction in which we are moving, to make the most of what we have.
Now, the Syrian conflict has been allowed to faster for a number of years until its shockwave started reaching Europe in the form of refugees and in the form of terrorists. And it was only at that point that many European capitals took a very proactive step on the Syrian conflict. I wonder if the Ukrainian crisis has been allowed to, you know, simmer unresolved precisely because, you know, Europe is still largely insulated from its repercussions.
Actually, I have a bit of a contrary concern there, because there has been a strong interest for Ukraine and for the role of the OSCE in Ukraine. And when I was in New York for the General Assembly, I saw, in fact, the focus was moving to other areas. And of course, Daesh and Syria and other issues, which are, without any doubt, of great importance and of great concern. But I wouldn't want that this, in the end, results in us putting the issue of the conflict and the crisis in and around Ukraine on a second level, because it may have a significant impact also in future on intra-European relations. Mm-hmm. So we need to keep it high on the agenda, and we need to invest in all possible means to solve it.
But I wonder if that's even possible, to put Ukraine on the back burner, because, you know, if you compare those two conflicts, despite having some of the same actors, up until recently they remained largely separated, and the Russian-Turkish tensions may change that. You know, because of the sort of multidimensional nature of the current geopolitics, how worrisome would that be if Syria and Ukraine would become even more interlinked?
Well, I think it would be good to try to keep the issues separate at this point, even though the interlinkages will be there and the repercussions on one or the other will be there. But we have a strong focus, and when I mentioned that the Ukraine issue is there is a risk that it loses somehow visibility, this is not from an OSCE perspective. In the OSCE, it is, I would say, the central topic on the agenda of the organization. But I'm taking a broader look at where the international community is focused on. In OSCE terms, if you think paradoxical in a way, but the mission, which is so strongly supported by everybody, including by Russia, and there are Russian monitors there, is led by a Turkish diplomat who is extremely good and extremely well respected by everybody. So even a complication in the relations is not affecting the way Turkey operates within the OSCE, and I hope I will not see that kind of repercussion.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.